Welcome to another edition of Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. You can find out more at my website, allbook-books.com. This week, it's an interesting interview with Mindy Cronenberg about what's going on in the schools and with the literary and creative pursuits and institutional influence on all of that. Mindy Cronenberg is a widely published poet, writer, critic, and professor of writing and the arts at SUNY, State University of New York, SUNY Empire State College. Her work has appeared in hundreds of print and online journals around the world, in numerous anthologies and video recordings, and she has been featured in art exhibits at galleries and museum installations. She's the author of Dismantling the Playground, a poetry chapbook, Images of America, Miller Place, a pictorial history, and an illustrated book of poems, Open. Ms. Cronenberg is a board member of Inspiration Plus, an arts initiative that educates through linking art to science, and is an arts education presenter with BOCES. That's B-O-C-E-S, which stands for Boards of Cooperative Educational Services of New York State. She's the editor of Oberon Poetry Magazine, now in its 20th year, and a trustee of the Miller Place Mount Sinai Historic Society, and a poet participant in the International Ekphrasis Project. Ekphrasis, E-K-P-H-R-A-S-I-S. That's poems that go with artworks, poems written about art. So it's a nice collaborative effort there. And she recently performed with Argentinian pianist Axel Quinque, Q-U-I-N-C-K-E, and artist Dan Weldon in a special presentation for LTV, Piano Poet Painter. So, here's the interview with Mindy Cronenberg.
All right, welcome Mindy Cronenberg to Get Lit with Literature. Thanks so much for making the time to talk with me.
My pleasure.
We were talking on the phone. First of all, we know each other many years through the Long Island poetry community.
Yes.
And we were talking a week or so ago, and I was asking you about, you know, how school was. You were a teacher for, I think you said 31 years?
31 at Empire State College.
Okay.
Probably 40.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. So we were talking on the phone, and after like 5 minutes or so, I was like, wow, it was so fascinating. I thought this would make a great interview. So here we are. And
okay. What
fascinated me was hearing, you know, your take on what's going on now. And it fits in with the podcast because part of the aim of the podcast is, as the title says, is to get people excited and enthused or whatever other way that they're inspired by literature. And the way you were describing the school process or what's become sort of the standard fare is seemingly as much from the bureaucracy of the school itself and the students it sounded like the students are not so much into learning about literature today or the nuances, but it's more like a stepping stone to some goal they want to attain, like some credit.
Yeah,
so maybe talk about all that.
Yeah, I think it's a societal syndrome rather than just a school, but schools have become more like businesses. And, students provide tuition and financial aid, and this is unfortunate. It's happened also, as many of us know, with our healthcare system. Everything's a business. And so in businesses, you need clients, you need customers. And that message, I think, has been pervasive, even beyond education. People have to, and they've always done this through the decades, they've had to reinvent themselves. We saw a lot of people come back to school in the 70s. So the community colleges and some universities fill with middle-aged people who, through the recession, lost their jobs or found themselves divorced, having custody of kids, needing to get an education to get a better job or to get a job. And that's kind of become accelerated over time so that some students come in, the ones who are interested in literature, interested in the arts and humanities, they will always be there, although I don't know what the percentage is. But since a true liberal arts education includes a foundation of subjects that are very important, really, in helping us form a worldview of enlarging our perspectives, things like history, things like literature, even things like science, Western civilization. These are not simply stuffy subjects. These are things that can really broaden our understanding of where we come from and where we are and where we should be going, teach us about ourselves. They've been downplayed because these are not moneymakers. These are not the industries. You know, you don't have somebody coming in getting a degree in philosophy because there's a big call for philosophers out there, you know, philosophy professors. We've kind of isolated some subjects and made them highfalutin, and in the process, dismissing or diminishing their importance in how they could help fulfill and nurture the imagination and the scholarship of the average person. So that's been happening over time. What I see teaching for so many years, and I talk about this with my fellow professors and instructors, and even people who teach at the high school level, the message is to accelerate in time what you can learn, what you can get, and it's a matter of acquisition in addition to, or rather than, achievement. I was thinking about this earlier this morning, anticipating our phone call, and some conversations I've had with students this week. The school has opened. We are at the beginning of a term in a new academic year, and there are many questions, there's anticipation, there's anxiety on some students who are coming into college for the first time, or coming back after so many years, which is a lot of the student body that we get at Empire State College. And we talk about those things we anticipate and expect of college, which is sometimes not exactly what we get. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of learning that goes on that's not anticipated and is a pleasant surprise. We learn a lot about ourselves. But if we also get students who come in and one of the first questions is, how fast can I do this?
Amazing.
Isn't it? And years and years ago, there was more of a concern of, am I up for this task? What can I get from, what can I learn from this? You know, there is something to be said about engagement. I'm a big fan of this. And I tell all my students and try to work with them as best I can in engaging them in what they're learning. They want a piece of paper, some of them, not all of them. But again, in our society, there's a pervasive message of acquisition and getting something, accelerating the time and going for the goal, you know, going for the higher paid position. And when you keep your eye on the prize, you're losing sense of the process that would get you there. It's, you know, the journey. We're losing sight of something our ancestors knew all about. It's not just where you land. It's what you've gone through and been through and learned on the way to that plateau or to that place. And so I tell all my students, and it's a delight to see them sometimes come to terms with this and appreciate it. The math majors, the history majors, although the history majors are better with this because we've come to learn how to teach history better through personal narratives, through looking into the lives of historic figures rather than just black and white cutouts that we must learn about as our duty to our nation and our knowledge of the world. Humanizing education to see how important things are to know, to revisit ourselves as people and to see our place in the world and to learn about others, to break down barriers and to create bridges of understanding. It's not a new concept, but I think slowly we've kind of chipped away at that because we're not paying as much attention to it. And part of that is just slowing down and immersing and engaging in the process. And some of this has to do with discourse. It's been on my mind a long time. I'm writing this essay that never seems to get finished because I'm too busy living it and then trying to decide what to add, what to take out. But the death of discourse, conversation, scholastic dialogue, you know, Socratic exchanges. I hate to think of education being seen as an intellectual exercise. Certainly it has that element in it. But anybody who loves to read, who loves to be told a story, who loves to be taken to a place in their imagination where they've never been, understand the beauty of what learning is. Adding words to your vocabulary, because those words represent something. We forget that our very language represents things. It's not simply a matter of putting an 11-letter word on a page to impress or puzzle people. It's each word has its origin in something. We lose connection with all of this. We lose connection with the pleasure and the beauty of knowing something in addition to what we didn't know. The lack of opportunity for a serendipitous detour. And conversation can bring that. I'm concerned about it because a lot of what I do happily involves conversations with students. But COVID encouraged this. You know, there's a lot of online activity. And that has its own kind of discourse. But it's kind of an interrupted discourse. And you don't necessarily have a spontaneous in-person or real-time conversation with someone where things can happen unanticipated. And very often that's not in the presence of each other. Because of COVID and because of the way that our society's temperament is, and for practical reasons, more and more people are working home now, for instance. It started with COVID, and they find that it suits their lifestyle, or it allows them to do certain things. And it's economic, you know. You're not spending money on gas. You're not spending time in traffic, whatever. We're not in the presence of each other. And when I started teaching, at other universities, and, of course, we had classes and lecture halls. And in Empire, and we still do this for independent study, it's kind of a one-on-one, but much of what we did, especially in the Long Island campuses, is that someone would come in and we would talk. We would talk about the readings. We would examine and explore things that we found interesting or puzzling. And I would have a student in my office. And many times it would be things I would have hanging in my office. I have all sorts of artwork and photographs, literary figures and artists. And, you know, almost invariably they would sit across from me and so their eye would catch something. And oh, who is that? And I remember introducing a student to Frida Kahlo. There was a picture of her and they found her kind of interesting looking and we talked about that. And there's a nugget of something that was unanticipated, certainly not intended. We were talking about a literary subject, but you don't have that kind of serendipitous detour occurring if you don't have that opportunity or that situation. I kind of worry a little for that. I know I benefited from it.
Wow, yeah, you just said so many things, so many amazing things. I could go in many directions. Serendipitous detour. I love that phrase because that's part of my creative process. And it's kind of like not, I think things are so formulaic because some of what you're describing so packaged that the idea that you can not know and be okay is, you know, that you can not know something and be okay is becoming kind of foreign. There's a book, years ago, I didn't read the book, but the title has always stayed with me, Alan Watts' book called The Wisdom of Insecurity, which is kind of like, to me, it says, like, it's you cannot know. It's like, it's okay to not, you know, to find out, like, to be insecure with the in that feeling of not exactly knowing rather than it being in a panic, but sort of like a welcome.
Yeah.
You know, you find your way through it rather than trying to eliminate that, which seems like, you know, some of what that career path, that's one of the things that stood out to me, what you were talking about, was sort of like the, you know, the career path becomes the thing as opposed to, say, the life path or somebody, you know, finding their own sort of inner whatever to guide their life. And then they can overlap, but
Yes, but, you know, it's a path and not a journey.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's following and staying on the line and moving forward, but not necessarily immersing or appreciating or being aware of what you're picking up en route to what you want to gain.
Oh, yeah. I think you gave the answer for what's going on, because the word that jumped out was to me was accelerate. Which is, I mean, that reminds me, like, I drove an SUV for many years until, like, a little over a year ago. I got a Nissan sportier car now. But the acceleration with the SUV was not good. And what I experienced, like, getting on the highway and, you know, certain places where it took me a little longer than the average vehicle, and I could feel and sometimes see, you know, the people behind me just getting impatient and sort of mildly freaking out, like, you know. And it just, to me, it's a reflection of what you're saying. This there's like acceleration is kind of like the accepted norm that you just barrel through things.
It's our societal temperament. There's a lot that contributes to it. Mm-hmm. We couldn't even cover most of it in this conversation, but it's noticeable. And we, you know, sometimes we see it in ourselves. You know, it used to be the joke with microwaves. You know, you're putting something in for 30 seconds, and people are sitting there tapping their fingers. I mean, really? You know, some of us who go back to the good old ovens and you know, the other ways of cooking, mm-hmm. 30 seconds would be nothing. We adjust, we adapt, we expect. And that happens, I think, in many areas in life. But I think also we have come to some extent of giving this message about the lessening of the value of the arts. You know, there are certain, I talked about this, with my husband who teaches music,
mm-hmm.
and is a musician. He's a jazz musician. I mean, you talk about things that people don't go into to make money. And, you know, usually the cup is out in the subway.
Right.
But, you know, just how those kinds of programs were cut very early. Now things are starting to turn around a little bit, but they were not considering the arts something as practical, whatever the heck that is supposed to mean. When anybody who's done real studies shows that children and adults who get into music and who learn about art helps not just their it broadens their perspective, but it helps their critical thinking. It helps the brain process things. And in actuality, there is something practical about it. It may not make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if we're going to have a corporate mentality, that bottom line may not be met by most people. But certainly to increase the value of what understanding and appreciation and how something can help us figure other things out, you know, the connection between things, the relevance of things. It's kind of like when I have students taking poetry courses. What I love is when I get people who are math majors, like I was saying, science majors, or going into human services, and they stayed away from poetry. They're taking it because their advisor told them it would be a good thing to have. It was a default kind of registration, or they were just curious about it. Or they stayed away from it most of the time because they thought they'd never understand it. And then they start to see, well, poetry is written by human beings.
Mm-hmm.
So lo and behold, there might be a poem you could relate to. And how satisfying to know that other people might be experiencing something that you've experienced. They can say something eloquently that you never could quite say for yourself. But there it is on the page, in language, that you think about. And then maybe you give yourself permission to think more about these things and create something of your own. So now I'm proud to say I have students over the years, mathematicians, librarians, historians, social workers, and every now and then I'll get an email saying, you know, I wrote another poem.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, it's fantastic. And, yeah. And they're lovely. They're perfectly lovely. And they go to readings, and not all of them become poets per se, and that they pursue it. But they became certainly fans of poetry. They support the poetry community by being active and appreciative listeners and readers. And so this, you know, a community can grow in so many ways, not just by the practitioners, by the people who come to understand and learn more about what those practitioners are doing, especially artists. And you have to have that in order to help it flourish.
Yeah, when you mentioned the music, it made me think of, I had seen a video online that was Native women singing, like the Native peoples have songs for, say, the rivers. They were singing, like, to the waters. And that struck me because it's like a different form of arts or creativity. It's not just for self-glorification or success. It's like,
oh, yeah,
it's part of the caring for the where one lives and the habitats. And I think, you know, from what you described, again, that career path, and it's very self-centered, very, you know, anthropocentric, that people are approaching their, you know,
yeah,
their education that way.
It's like the question of, you know, where do you want to be? Where do you want to be in 5 years? Where do you want to? And, you know, it would be interesting to see how people answer that.
Yeah.
I don't think most people would say, well, I want to know a lot more about the world. You know, I think when they're asked that question, the context in which they're asked is, would be a corporate context, a practical, a so-called practical. You know, what do you want to acquire within that time period? How do you pursue that? And then you lose the sense of other things. This is not to say we must not have a life plan.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we have to. We have to support ourselves. But we can lose a lot if we're not paying attention to what happens en route to those various practical, or so-called practical goals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So what are the things that students are open to or receptive to nowadays as far as, you know, literarily or anything else that, you know, you teach? Are there certain things where they kind of break out of that spell of, you know, get me my diploma so I can get out of here?
Yeah, some do. I mean, some will be perfectly fine, adequate, or even terrific students in terms of reading, critically analyzing, getting their papers in on time, doing all the right things. They know how to measure and they know how to produce. Whether or not they go on to continue to be interested in anything that they've read is anybody's guess. But my philosophy is, if I can engage them and make them see certain things using my own excitation,
mm-hmm.
since I'm a writer myself, I'm not simply an academic. I'm not, you know, I know the value of these things, but I know them from the inside. I know that poetry, as you know me, and literature is a very big part of my life. It's part of my personal creative scholarship and my personal practice. And I try to impart that, you know, I try to include that in how I teach. It's not just what you teach, it's how you
mm-hmm.
teach. And I have to say that when you get over that hurdle, which you were saying before about, you know, it's okay not to know. One thing I like to do with students is assure them they're in college to learn. They're not in college to prove to us how much they already know.
Yeah.
Obviously, you should have some level of standard for yourself in terms of what you will provide scholastically, you know, being literate and gaining a sense of critical appreciation and communication. But it's okay not to know something. It's not okay not to want to know. And, you know, that's another part of learning, is desire to know something and being curious enough to sometimes wander outside the boundaries of what you hope to achieve or want to achieve.
Yeah, that plays out because one of my favorite things about writing, one of, and I forget it because it happens spontaneously, so I have to remind myself, oh yeah, that's one of my favorite things, is while writing, certain things come out, something comes to mind, or it goes onto the page.
Yes.
And that's while writing. And sometimes I step back and say, oh, wow, you know, that's amazing. Like, Somebody might think, wow, he's so smart, that's in his thing. And I'm thinking, no, I'm not that smart. It just kind of came out while I was writing. It's sort of a test to the unknowing and the getting into the enjoyment of the process where those surprises come out. And I think that to me is like one of the most exciting things. And if it's too formulaic, then that just numbs that process. So I think you're saying being open to that learning and encouraging people to go with it, even though they're not sure where it's going. I think that's important.
That's a very important thing, and it also brings something else into the picture. You know, everybody has a story.
Mm, yep.
They don't realize it. And I know one thing I love is when I teach college writing, and we have people who are, of course, they have this terrible fear. They will never be able to say anything that's intelligent or makes sense, or, you know, they fear the term paper, you know, the almighty term paper. But what we do a lot of essays, and we move from the personal, we cover some professional topics. I want people to see their voice and then hear their voice when we share them in the essays in class. And sometimes they will say, well, I have terrible writer's block, or they don't call it that, fear of writing or not knowing how to begin. And then I guarantee you, if you sit down to write, you will say something. And I have an exercise that I do when I have like classes with people who have this difficulty. I said, you can start by writing anything. Because they're not given a topic. They just start to write, okay? Maybe why you came into this class. And if you don't have anything to say, or you don't think you have anything to say, that's your first sentence. So, and I say, here's pens, pencils, whatever. We sit down. They have about 10 minutes. Or 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we sit down, and in the beginning, people are, you know, they're kind of shuffling their feet, and they don't know, they're kind of agitated. Within 7 minutes, people are writing. What are they writing? Well, some of them started out, I don't know what to say. I don't know why I'm like this. I can usually write letters. Well, anyway, they're moving. They're moving forward. They're moving forward because the thoughts are coming. And I tell them, if you have a mind that's active, if you're in generally good health, just start talking. Just start sharing. Write something. And by the time we're done, they have a page. And they take a look at it. They say, okay, it may not make tremendous sense outside the context of our exercise, but you certainly had something to say. And then we share them. And, you know, people have stories to tell. If you give them an opportunity, and you guide them, of course, it's not always as spontaneous like this, but if they have an opportunity and some guidance to tell their story, to put it into some guise that's relevant or in a particular context, they will tell their story,
mm-hmm.
and they will be surprised. Just as you were saying, what we discover when we're writing, the things that pop in there that have been cooking somehow, have been processing somehow. I'm not a scientist, but I know I read that, you know, and I think most of us know, you go about your day, you're absorbing so much, just in a sensual way,
mm-hmm.
sensory way. Things coming into our eyes, going into our brains, the things that we hear that we don't necessarily listen to. There's a lot that we're absorbing, and we're not focusing on all of it equally, but we gain something day in and day out from the experiences that we open ourselves to.
So much in there. I think that's, I call it like the storehouse, or maybe Ray Bradbury used that phrase, because I just like, you could say subconscious, whatever. It's all, like you said, bubbling, all the things we see all day, sights and sounds, and then when going to write, like, you don't know what's going to come out, but there's stuff in there.
Yeah.
Your description reminded, one time I got my nephew, who's big into sports, I got him, it was Christmas or a birthday present, it was a book called My Caddy Was a Reindeer. It was about some guy who went, you know, golfing in the Arctic or wherever. They have like these quirky tours and stuff. And so I started reading one of the chapters, and it proved to me that good writing can make something interesting, because I think the chapter was about like Italian sports car driving or something I had zero interest in. And there I was, like 5 or 10 pages into it, because the author was describing the way the jerseys were made, or there was something about the rubber for the car tires, and it was just so fascinating. The story of it was fascinating. But yeah. At first glance, I would say, nope, I have no interest. So it just proved to me that, you know, good writing can make anything interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And we have to leave ourselves open also, you know, but you were curious enough to approach that. You know, I have a body of work that I would call my NPR poems, because I would be listening to stories on NPR. And I have interests in a variety of things. I don't pursue each of these things equally with the same amount of time and investment. But I will hear something if I'm driving around, and I've had poems about planets, poems about certain life forms, poems about other countries. It's not that I had been thinking about it and determined to write something about, but just as you encountered, you know, that's an encounter. That's a valuable encounter. Leave ourselves open to approaching, and you never know what you're going to learn. And yes, it can turn into a piece of writing, whether it's a poem or an essay, or it's just part of a conversation you have with somebody else. And now you're kind of propagating and pollinating, and now they've learned something because of what you learned that you were eager to share with someone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of a way of carrying ideas across, which is nice. Well,
and everything. I was in the bathroom the other day just thinking about looking at a tube of toothpaste, and it was like there's a whole story in there, you know, somebody has a job, you know, filling that toothpaste. Little, you know, putting the cap on, that's a job, and then that person has a family, and, you know, on and on and on. It sounds obvious, but it was just reminding me that everything, you know, every object, every living energy, it's the wind blowing or the toothpaste, it's like there's some story in there that connects to people and places and all kinds of stuff. So, so to kind of start wrapping up, like, where do you see things changing or going in any different direction, or is it like it's sort of on this sort of corporate track that's seemingly hard to get off now?
Well, you know, it's hard for, I think, most societies to get off, or ours in particular, to get off the corporate track because of what will motivate people, what will control them in a sense. It's also our elected officials, how they prioritize things, what happens in the schools. There are many mechanisms in our society that impact this. So it's hard to say. I'm very much a populist. I think if somebody wants a college education, everybody should have an opportunity to get one, whether it's for personal enrichment, or for something more practical, in quotes, something to help support themselves or to do better for themselves and their families. But I think that we all could have a role in this by being more aware ourselves, supporting those communities, whether being a participant or attending events, certainly making donations to certain events, just being a fan of, a participant of, and engaging others. If we continue to engage others in conversation, in writing, we carry ideas back and forth. I think it's important to keep the philosophical, the meditative, the act of discovery. I think if we continue to have conversations with each other, that's very helpful.
Oh yeah, you just we connected a month or so ago. You organized the CEED, Center for Environmental Educational Development. Is that it?
CEED, Center for Environmental Education and Discovery.
Yeah, and so that was a wonderful example of the community and the interaction between, instead of like narrow-minded, just poets, just artists, it was, you know, environmental people, groups. I talked with some very intelligent, very interesting younger, you know, younger people. And then there was artists and sculptors and poets. And so that kind of thing is, I already connected with some of the other artists and younger or environmental people. And they were, you know, one of them is interested in my poetry, you know, poetry. And so that kind of networking and community, I agree with you. I think that's important to get us sort of pollinating amongst ourselves and getting out and about and crossing the genres or the boundaries that are sometimes put on categorically.
Yes, and it's raising awareness. I mean, that's a very important part of it. You know, when you talk about the environmental aspect and bringing the arts in, that was such a joy to work with at my group that I'm aboard, a member mm-hmm. of Inspiration Plus, and having you and the other poets was such a marvelous experience. It's those are the kinds of things that energize me.
Yeah, I agree. One other question, I think, let's see, have you noticed, this is kind of a sweeping question, you could probably write a 4-volume book on it, but over your years teaching, have you noticed any kind of phases? I mean, obviously the computers and the gadgets has accentuated. I remember talking to one English professor in the poetry community years ago, and he commented that, this was a bunch of years ago, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, he said that, like, the quality of kind of writing, you know, just basic writing skill or whatever had gone down, probably because of the sort of some of the technology sort of making things more simplistic in certain ways. Have you noticed anything along those lines over your
teaching? Yes. I get a little agitated about this. Let's not blame. We can certainly say that the use of technology,
right,
our use of technology has done that. But we can't blame the technology because the machines don't think, we do.
Mm-hmm.
We have to program them to function, not overtake certain things that we do, like thinking, like articulating, because of the change in temperament, because of the acceleration of what machines allow us to do, it's truncated our use of language. And people don't communicate or articulate as thoroughly, maybe, on the whole, as they used to, because they're throwing messages back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my students use email in the same way that they would use Messenger. They're expecting email was meant to conveniently convey a message, but then you need the other party to read it, absorb it, and come up with an answer.
Right.
That's not necessarily true when they do it on their phones, which is another thing, because now, you know, you get the internet on your phone and you can do anything on your phone you can do on a computer. I think it's certainly our use of technology is part of it. I really do believe the other thing is we've cut into discourse. We've cut into conversation. Because if you sit and have a conversation with someone, not a 3-second, I'm nodding, you're grunting, you're giving me a number or one word, we've said what we have to say because we've gotten our info. If you sit down and talk to people and they have to think while they're speaking and respond to what the other person presents, I mean, that helps us elongate our messages, our phrases. It increases our articulation. I think writing and speaking and conversing, these things all work together. I don't think people stand. I'm going to sound like an old-fashioned, you know, marm here, but family sitting down and having conversation at dinner. People who live together, do they sit down and have conversations? Many times people are gathering together, but they are looking at the computer or their phones, or they're looking at something on television. And again, there's no real conversing. So I think if we provide more opportunity for conversations and are articulating off the top of our heads things that we've read, responding to other people, and just reading, frankly, Monk, because that's a biggie. We have to continue reading, not skimming, not looking at headlines, not simply seeking things in areas that we know will feed us, and things in the industries we're interested in. As you were saying before, looking at those articles. Some of the airlines had this, at least pre-COVID, magazines with articles on all sorts of things, essays on all sorts of subjects. And I found it fascinating that I could have a plane ride and learn just from what I picked up serendipitously. I think that that's important, is the way, or the way that we absorb language and can use it more effectively. We have to pay attention to that, not let the idea of technology rob us of that, because that's, we're in charge of that. We should be in charge of it.
Yeah, Mindy, I like so much how you're accentuating the discourse and the conversation and the need to kind of de-accelerate, slow down, take time to smell the roses and the coffee and all that stuff. I think that the combination of slowing down and making time to communicate with each other, and things are not so, I think what you're touching on is a kind of scriptedness. There's a scriptedness of society nowadays with, you know, whether it's news, media, and entertainment, and I think what you're calling for is sort of the, you know, be open to the unscripted and see where it goes, because that's the vulnerable place, or that's where the sort of the creativity is, it comes out of.
Yes, you know, leave yourself open for the unexpected, for the unanticipated. You never know where you'll learn something. Mm-hmm. You'll never know where something catches your attention and is a springboard mm-hmm. for other ideas, whether you're a writer or not. This is how we, you know, we open up the world. This is where we pick up things without necessarily intending to pick up things. I think it's a shame sometimes when I'm behind a van. I was just talking about this to someone, and there are kids in the van, and they're watching a monitor. They've got a TV in the van to keep them quiet, and they're showing cartoons, probably that they've seen at home a million times.
Yeah.
Which means they're not looking out the window.
Exactly.
And noticing things that might actually mean something to them later on. And, people walk down the street, they're looking at their phones. They're not paying attention to what's around them. I don't know if this is still true, but I know many years ago when I was in England, I was staying in an old hotel, the Regent Hotel, and one of the very few Americans there. And there were people in the lounge just sitting in chairs, many of them admittedly older than me. I was only in my 20s, but they were just kind of sitting there. And someone, I was in a conversation with someone at the desk, and I just made a comment. I said, I noticed there are people just sitting there, and we're in the U.S. They would need something to read, or they would need somehow to connect to something. And this wasn't even the days of cell phones and computers. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, there's nothing. We find it perfectly fine to sit and simply contemplate, you know, national pastime.
Doesn't go out of style. You know.
But think about it. People don't like to eat by themselves unless they've got the phone. There are things that we can take notice of if we're not constantly in motion and looking at a screen. We leave ourselves open to things outside ourselves.
All right. That's a wonderful, wonderful place to leave it open-ended instead of trying to come to some conclusion, because it's ongoing. So where, Mindy, where can people find out more about your writings and poetry? Do you, I mean, anything you want to say that direct people to, I don't know, if, you know, you do anything?
They can Google me. I'm not the Mindy E. Cronenberg, who's a psychologist.
Okay.
We get each other's books, which is really hilarious. I get things for review on child psychology, and I think, nope, they got the Mindy Cronenberg. But if you know, just do Mindy Cronenberg poet, or look on Facebook.
Okay.
I have a website at the college. If you put me in, I think you probably pull that up anyway. There's a description that comes up. And anybody's interested, they can message me.
All right. It's Cronenberg, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Good for you. You got it right.
Hey, I should by now, knowing you a long while. So, yeah, thanks again, Mindy, for making the time. I know you got a busy teaching schedule, and enjoyed hearing your thoughts. It definitely stirred some more contemplating for me.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. It's always a pleasure.
All right. You take care. Be well.
You too. Bye-bye.